So here's the question. What is going on inside of the minds of top influencers and business professionals that are causing them to excel in their career and in life? My name's Tim Scherer. You're listening to Psychological Secrets for Skyrocketing Your Business, and the answers you've been seeking are in this podcast.
I'm excited to introduce a very special guest. I met Mick Cameron a little while ago, and we got to know each other, and it was really, you know, it's one of those people where you meet and you're like, oh, I've got to interview this guy. He has a world of experience and some unique experiences that I thought would be really helpful for you. And so let me introduce Mick. So he spent the last 35 years installing and changing corporate leadership cultures, ranging from small third-generation family-owned companies to huge multinational companies. And much of his career was spent in both America and in Germany, specifically in the auto industry, where he also ended up finishing another career, another part of his career in the medical products industry as vice president and COO of a very large product manufacturer. He's lived in Germany for many years as well as America, and he lives in Indiana currently. And he has a huge knowledge of European leadership styles and business practices. And, of course, he also has a world of knowledge when it comes to American business practices. In fact, he is an adjunct instructor at Indiana Wesleyan University and DeVos School of Business. And he teaches managerial leadership and economics. And he's got a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Purdue and an AS in German language, which I'll ask him what an AS is. And you know, he just has degrees from Germany and from business management, and he's very well educated. He's got a lot of street smarts as well. So I could spend the next hour talking about all the accolades that Mick has acquired over his lifetime. But we're going to jump right into the questions. So, Mick, thank you for being here and welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate it.
Yes,
good
absolutely.
To be with you this morning.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's good to have you here. So give me a little synopsis of your background from where you started to where you got to where you are today.
Well, in my professional career, I was incredibly lucky to come out of college. And as most of us will probably sympathize with this, when we come out of college, we have very, very little leadership and management skills.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what discipline you're in, whether you're on the business side or the technical side, and I've been on both.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get educated at all in business leadership skills. And mm-hmm. I had the great fortune to work for 13 years for what the old management guru, I hate to call him old, I have to tell Tom he's old now, but Tom Peters, and Tom wrote many, many books and was considered the real guru of management and leadership styles back in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a company that he deemed as one of the five best-run companies in the world in the last decade. And the key to their success was their people empowering management style. Now,
mm-hmm.
don't get me wrong, this wasn't your, and nothing against mom and pops, but this wasn't your mom and pop employer with 40 people. This was a Fortune 100 company with 60,000 people, 157 facilities worldwide. And that people empowering management style was just permeated from the top down through all those organizations, and really was the key to their success. This was a company that was in the auto parts industry, the OEM auto parts industry. I don't mean to sound like it's aftermarket type thing, but you know, supplying to the large auto manufacturers all around the world. And if anybody is familiar with that business, there isn't a more competitive business in the world than that business.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has the same ability to get the right technical people, the right human resource people. But what set this company apart and made them the world leader was their management style and the motivation that brought through with their people. They had an extremely motivated workforce. And it was funny. I would talk to competitors out there, the large OEMs of the world, the TRWs and the BorgWarners and all those out there, and they were like, how do you guys do it? What's the secret? Why are you out competing us on everything? And we used to kind of just smile and say, it's something that everyone else doesn't put a value on, and that's how motivated their people can be. And fortunately, we put a value on that. So I was immersed in that for the first 13 years of my career by blind luck, just happened to come out of college and be immersed in that. And then I had the great fortune to leave that company, which nobody else left. Everybody was like, oh my goodness, this is a great company. And it was. I didn't leave there because it wasn't a great company. But I wanted to try to take those skills and take those to other companies and see if we can change the culture there to make their workforce more competitive and more motivated, and ultimately the company more competitive. Mm-hmm. So, what a fun thing to be able to do. And those travels led me to Germany to work for the largest OEM manufacturer in the world, the Robert Bosch Corporation. Everybody knows Bosch for probably their power tools and their dishwashers and all those appliances and things like that. But they are the largest, and I would dare to say the highest tech automotive component supplier in the world. And kind of blend those cultures of the German culture with a people empowering style, and then bring that back to a few companies here in the United States too. So it's been a fun journey. It hasn't always been totally successful. As people will understand out there, there's a lot of talk the talk and not walk the walk, when it comes to empowering management styles. And some people just can't buy into it and don't see the value in it. But those who do and do get immersed in it really start to see the value in it and really sets themselves apart as a company.
That brings up a really interesting question. It's something that I've been working on really hard for the last couple of months. And so let me ask you, when you run into somebody who's very resistant, and there's reasons for that. Sometimes people feel like their success was built on how they are, and they don't want to mess with the secret formula that has made them successful. Mm-hmm. Other people don't want to look like they're somehow wrong. It's an ego thing, right? They don't want their significance being messed with. But if you if you approach somebody and you realize that maybe you've got a president and a COO, and one's on board and the other is very resistant, how do you get around the resistance?
I face this all the time when I'm trying to help people. And the thing I really like to do is connect them with people who have experience and have some real credibility in this, people at other companies that do this type of thing. Because, Tim, the thing we really find out is, and this is going to be as obvious as anything, you can't go in and change a corporate culture instantly.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that's a resistance factor. It doesn't change instantly. You have to really be proud of small results. And the other thing is, it's so hard to quantify.
Mm-hmm.
We can quantify upgrades in technology from installing capital equipment or robotics and see quantify that instant improvement, how much faster and with higher quality we can build a product. But it's hard to quantify the motivation when the motivation of your whole organization increases and you start getting people that will, do things quicker, faster, and with more innovation and all that. It's hard to quantify that. So people get bogged down, and that's their excuse. Well, I don't see the results. Well, yeah, you do see the results in the bottom line, but it's hard to quantify them in a very finite method. So I really like to get people hooked up with some of the great leaders that have credibility because their companies are so successful, and have them sit down for a small discussion and tell them, yeah, you know, a lot of this is due to the motivation of our people, not because we can buy robotics to put our products together. Everybody can buy the same robotics. That's not the edge we have. The edge we have is in our people and their creativity and their motivation, because we empower them to have that creativity and that motivation. And you know, somebody speaking from you know, a really successful company, a lot of times I will come back and I'll hear a different attitude. Hey, I'm willing to try this. I'm willing to, you know, embrace these techniques to improve my motivation and kind of take the leap of faith that, yes, in the end, I'm going to see big results.
I like that answer a lot. Yeah, showing, demonstrating success and talking to other people who are admired in the field, you know, that social proof is huge. And then approaching it like we're all, you know, comrades here, right? We're all in this together. And so being able to show, hey, I want to win as badly as you do, and I want to be as successful as you do, and this is another way of approaching it. And so I've always tried to use as far as metrics, because a lot of people, they just like you said, they want the KPIs. They want to know how do we measure this so that we know it's worth our money. And I think that the whole business world is really moving in this direction right now, where we are focused on empowering our workforce and moving away from that more of a dictator mode. And so we'll use KPIs like employee satisfaction survey scores. In fact, a lot of companies that I get brought into is a result of them surveying their employees for maybe the very first time, and then realizing,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that aha moment of, wow, hey, I thought that people were a lot happier than they actually are. Or I thought we were doing a lot better in certain areas than they're telling us. And that opens them up to the possibility of what could we be doing better. Because a lot of companies are realizing that you just can't rest on your past successes anymore, because other people are coming up too fast. And even if you're number one now, you won't be for long if you're not always continually looking for ways to grow. So, wonderful. So let me ask you this then. If you could travel back through time, you know, maybe back to when you were a kid, knowing all the stuff that you know now, what advice would you give your younger self based on the experiences that you have now? Because people always say, if I knew then what I know now, it would have been a lot easier.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So what advice would you give that that little boy that you were once?
Oh, I would, number one, I would say never, ever, ever be afraid to try things and to fail. And I know that's kind of an old cliche, but, and the other part of the old cliche is, you learn as much from failing as you do from succeeding. And I will disagree with that. I will say you learn much more from failing than you do from succeeding. Succeeding is great, but failing really leaves an impression in your mind. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to dwell on failures, and you don't want to, you know, get a lot of scar tissue from failures in your mind. But you do learn a lot from failures.
Yeah.
And one of the things, especially in kids, and I try to, you know, impress upon that on my daughter. It's a way to find out what you like and what you don't like, as far as things to do in life. And in a way, it also makes you kind of fearless when you become an adult to try different things. And this is not only to, I would tell this to kids, I would tell this to probably more to parents, is, you know, you're so influential on your kids. And I know what we as parents are trying to do. We're trying to steer our kids in the right direction. But I think we kind of steer a little bit too cautiously and too much of a, in a finite line. Let them venture out a little bit more. I mean, obviously, we don't want them to do be so fearless they do dangerous things and harmful things and all that. But, you know, close that window down to just that, And if it's not dangerous, if it's not harmful, it's not going to have a long-lasting effect, let them try it. And if they find out they don't like it or they fail or both, that'll really serve them well as an adult, both in their, you know, in their general life with their spouse or partner and in the business world. You know, the other thing is it's fun. It's fun to try new adventures, even knowing you're going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I people have asked me many, many times, especially old colleagues of mine at the company I worked for right out of college for 13 years that was so world famous with their management style. They said, why did you ever leave? You know, and I said, well, yeah, I could have hunkered down and said, wow, this is going to be a great place to be for the next 30 or 40 years or however long I decide to work
mm-hmm.
in my career. And it's going to be, you know, obviously a very enjoyable place to work as long as the culture doesn't change. Now, the culture in that company has changed a little bit because of that leadership that was really pushing that people empowerment style. That leadership has kind of left, and we know what positional power does. When positional power changes, the culture is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the point, I decided to leave that company because I had an opportunity to go to live in Europe, work in the German culture, and experience that. And I thought to myself, even if it's a so-called failure, what a great opportunity in life to go experience something like that. I'm not going to get a lot of opportunities to go work for a world-class company in a foreign country and all that type of thing. So to me, it was an adventure. I didn't have that fear of failure in the sense of, hey, if it didn't work out that great, you know, I'll do something else.
Mm.
So I think too many times we try to protect our kids too much
mm-hmm.
and pick the safe and perfect route. And if we just kind of let that unfold, I think we'd find out they'd be a lot better off. So,
well, that is real wisdom because, well, first of all, how do you become resilient and how do you learn to bounce back if you don't get knocked down? And I think resilience is key to being successful. You have to keep figuring how to keep moving forward, because whether it's business or it's your personal life or it's your health or it's your marriage or it's with kids, you're going to have unexpected challenges. You're going to have times where it is hard and it's knocking you down. And if you don't know how to get back up, you're going to have a real difficult time. So I've always told people that if there is no failure, there's just feedback, right? And if you just get feedback and you just keep learning every time you do anything, that's what makes you a success. It's not that something that you do makes you successful. I think success is a way of being. And so I love your ideas of not trying to protect people too much, because that backfires anyway. You're not going to protect people from pain, right? That happens. Pain's a part of life. Suffering's optional.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, and I love your analogy of that too. It's not going to happen. You can try to protect people all you want, but sooner or later,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to be in a position to protect them. And
right.
You're right. I see it. You know, I've hired, you know, directly or indirectly thousands of people,
mm-hmm.
and I see the people come in, and you can tell right away the ones who've kind of lived that protected life. You're right. The minute they run into some adversity, it's tough on them.
Mm-hmm.
The others, they bounce right back and move on.
Yes.
And to think you're going to live your entire life, especially in the business world, and never face adversity and be able to, you know, maneuver through that without having any setbacks is obviously just totally unrealistic.
Well said.
And
well,
you know, said. You have to embrace it. You have to embrace those and say, you know, I know I'm going to face adversity, but I have to make sure that I learn from that adversity so that I can have a more positive outcome in the future. And look at it as, hey, this may the final goal. This may enhance the final goal by having two or three setbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we really looked at it. You know, Tom Peters talks about it in his book when he was doing all the surveys of our company and other companies. he called it creating fast failures.
Mm-hmm.
You try things, you fail, you don't dwell on them, you learn, and you move on quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't let that stifle your thirst for innovation and trying things just because you had a setback. And most of the time, the companies that do that find out their outcome, whatever that may be, a new product or whatever, was a better product because of the couple failures that happened in the initial stages of developing that product.
Mm-hmm.
It made it a better product. If they hadn't had those failures, it wouldn't be as good of a product. And I totally think that's true. Absolutely.
Yeah, I heard a story about how some company was working on creating a glue that would be permanent, and they failed because they ended up with this product that could easily, you could stick it on something and it would come right off.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned that into Post-it notes, and so now 3M is a billion-dollar product line.
I was going to say, it's called the 3M company, and it was the Post-it note adhesive was an accident.
Yeah.
And now it's one of their main revenue streams and has been for years. So great example. Couldn't find a better example than that, really.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, you ever get scared now? And if so, how do you handle it?
Oh, yeah. Especially, I'm retired from the corporate world. But yeah, when you're leading a $500 million organization and a lot of people's jobs are on the line and you care about those people and you care about the financial well-being of the entity as a whole,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think you get a little fearful sometimes. But you know what, Tim? The more times you fail and then you come back and succeed, the more confidence it gives you that there isn't too much in the world, or in our case, the business world that we're talking about, that can set us back permanently. There just isn't too much. And, I've had some owners of companies that I've ran their divisions for, and public companies that have had board of directors that have come along with some pretty, off-the-wall kind of ideas, and we've had to say, well, maybe let's take that in smaller steps, but let's not stop the innovative thinking altogether. Maybe let's just take it in smaller steps and kind of see how it goes. We're going to fail a few times. It won't be detrimental to the company from the standpoint of jeopardizing the whole solvency of the company. So kind of handling it in that way. Let's not just stop that idea in its tracks before we can get it started, but let's maybe break it up into smaller parts and try it. And kind of handling it that way and in a sense, if we cut it up into four parts, let's cut the fear factor by in fourths.
Yeah.
And take it that way and step through it. And that's always been a pretty good way to take, having a motivated workforce and successful people trying to innovate, there is a downside to it. People become so fearless that they want to hit gigantic home runs every time. And you can look into the future and say, yeah, if we hit that home run, it's going to be just tremendously valuable to this company. And if we don't, it can be pretty detrimental. So let's just try to break that up, hit a couple singles, and see where it goes. And eventually, we'll get to the home run. And that's tended to work out. I'd rather do that than say, since it could be not a home run, it could be a big failure, let's forget the idea altogether. No way. We wouldn't have iPhones. We wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have Google. We wouldn't have any of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, break it up into small parts and try it that way.
That's a brilliant strategy. So I got to summarize two things that you said, because for our listeners, you dropped a huge nugget of gold right there, and I want to make sure that people picked it up. So I like to ask people who have been successful, you know, flat out, if they still get scared, because it causes us to stop and think and to really go within. And I loved your answer. You get caught up in it sometimes, but because you've had the courage to get knocked down and get back up and keep going at it, you know, in fact, I have a friend, Willie Jolly, that wrote a book that's called A Setback is a Setup for a Comeback. And I always thought that was a great way of looking at it. And so your answer of the more you take risks and the more you put it on the line, the more you grow, the stronger you become, and the more secure you actually become inside, knowing that no matter what life throws at you, you're going to have the ability to handle it. You're going to be resourceful. You're going to be able to get through it. And that gives you a sense of faith and a feeling of confidence that allows you to navigate your business life and your personal life with much more confidence and much more grace. And so I think that's really important. And then the second part, which is a brilliant business strategy, is if you have this great, exciting goal, but you're nervous about it or it's a little too ambitious, break it up into pieces, those big goals into smaller goals. I like how you said, you know, take the fear and divide it by four. That's really clever. And so that way you can work on these smaller ideas and to never just throw away an idea, you know, which I think is also great. So a lot of wisdom there. So
never,
said,
never throw away an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's just absolutely 100% by your entire organization seen as an absolute cannot win.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I've seen ideas that you think just absolutely cannot win. People break them up. Peck away at them a little at a time, break them up into fourths, and sure enough, out of that comes a brilliant idea. More times than not, people are so deterred in business, and rightfully so. Again, you've got a lot of on the line, you've got employees to think about, payrolls, profitability, the entire solvency of the entity, you've got all that on the line. But that paralyzes them to a certain extent from taking enough risk and innovation to really succeed. They get so paralyzed, especially Tim, when they have a success. They start out a company and they have, I'm more manufacturing oriented than anything, so I'll use this example, but they start a small company and they come up with one product that's entirely successful, and they just grip that product with a death grip, like, hey, we've got the Big Mac sauce here. Let's not change it. Let's not do anything else. Let's just ride it. Oh my goodness, that kind of paralyzed thinking when it comes to innovation is just deadly for companies. Absolutely deadly. They'll be successful for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it's a mom-and-pop company, a small company with 50 employees, maybe that's all they're in it for is for a, you know, 10, 12, 15-year run.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're in it for the long run, that type of, hey, we got lucky, hit a home run, let's not jeopardize anything, let's not change anything with the current product, let's not look for new things to do, let's just hunker down and do that, that's deadly. Absolutely deadly.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you have to, you know, that old book title comes back again and again, you know, what got you here won't get you there. So you always have to be looking for ways to be relevant and sustainable as you move forward if you want to create a legacy.
Yeah, so true.
All right, I got three more questions for you. So if you had to start all over from scratch, you know, on a shoestring budget, what would be a couple things that you would do to build up a business right now?
I'm going to give you one that's going to sound, wow, this is old cliche. But this is one where, you know, there's two sides to every story. People never tell the second side of the story. The thing I would focus on the most is the obvious side. I would hire great people.
Mm.
And everybody think, well, wow, boy, this guy's, he's gotten this far in his career by that hiring great people. Everybody knows that. Well, what they don't know that I was taught and I utilized is that's only half of the story. You have to motivate those people better than anybody else. And that's what 95% of companies don't do. In fact, I had the famous corporate CEO of this company I worked for, who ended up being the dean of the business school at Stanford and Tom Peters' boss. How do you like that? He writes books about him and he becomes your boss. So he was telling the story about he would rather have mediocre people and teach them to be and empower them to be motivated rather than having really top-notch people hired in. You know, that's a general phrase, but and have them not be motivated. In other words, immersing people that are very, very talented in their field into a real authoritarian management style where they're not allowed to be creative and innovative and solve problems and create products and all those type of things. He'd rather have average people that are innovative and motivated because they're in a people-empowered management style. Now imagine that.
That is powerful. Yeah, that I love how you just open that up that way. I mean, that is really powerful. Because a lot of people think
you're
the smartest ones or the best ones, right? But they're not always the ones that you're going to get the most from.
Well, exactly. And not only that, but his point was, why would you take the best and the brightest and then put them in an environment where you're stifling them and not using their talents? You know what you're going to end up in the end? You're going to end up with an extremely frustrated, disgruntled employee because they are so talented, they want to unleash their talents. It's better for you to unleash have them unleash their talents, but you set on them and don't unleash their talents with your authoritarian management style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy, but you see this in 96% of the companies out there. They know how to hire, you know, great people or pretty good people. But then they totally squash their talents with this authoritarian management style they use to manage them. And the people, what do? The people get disgruntled, they don't perform well, and they end up leaving their company. And then they wonder, wow, that person wasn't that great of a company after all. No, that person was a very talented person. Your management style actually took the life right out of them. We just didn't do that.
Well, I want you to know that what you just said is so amazing and so powerful, and it's going to make a huge difference because there's people that I know out there in the world that are struggling with some of these issues. And what you just said was so powerful, and you've got the street cred. Right? You're one of those people, you know, your advice earlier, if you want to help somebody have a new perspective, bring someone who's been successful, who believes in creating a powerful culture and introduce them. And I'm going to be sharing this podcast with quite a few people that I know, and I'm going to introduce them to you and your wisdom and everything that you just said. So, and I hope that that expands their perspective and shows them what's possible. Because at the end of the day, these people that are ruling with an iron fist, when they have that transformation, they become loved because people knew how they were before. And then when they start to really appreciate those around them and they start empowering people, I think there's two reasons why people don't do it. One is they feel like they're too busy and they don't have time, which is really just an excuse. But the second reason is because a lot of times they're just afraid of being shown up. You know, they don't want to build leaders around them. because they don't want someone to take their job. Or they, why give you all the skills and all the knowledge just so you can go and start your own business and become my competitor? I mean, I've heard that many times over the years, but it's driven from fear. Yeah, and whenever you're coming from fear and scarcity, then you're always going to struggle. And when you come from abundance and you come from contribution and collaboration, you're always going to succeed beyond your wildest dreams. So, powerful stuff. Yeah.
Well, think about it this way, too. For folks out there, you know, think of the wide universe of business and all the types of companies that make products and make services of every type around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Don't they pretty much all have the same ability to get the same talent? And don't mm-hmm. they pretty much all achieve that goal of getting the best talent they can get? So doesn't it really come down to how you utilize your talent, not the initial skills of the talent? And the answer is yes. But 95% of us, well, I shouldn't say us, I won't include myself in that, but 95% of them choose to take that good talent, as good as their competitors, and not utilize it as a tool to make them better than their competitor.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to, as I always call it, as we used to say, squash that talent.
Mm-hmm.
And you get nothing but over years and years, you get just a mildly motivated workforce. People come and go because they're disgruntled. You hear a lot of, this is just like every other place out there. They don't want to hear what I've got to say. They say they have an open door policy, but they don't. My boss tells me everything to do, and boy, that's not very exciting to come to work when I know I have some great ideas, but they're not even going to be heard, and they're going to tell me exactly what to do because my boss, you know, has this management style that's authoritarian and the old boss knows everything mentality, so that he's supposed to tell us everything, what to do and how to do it. I mean, how exciting is that to get up in the morning, take your shower, and while you're in the shower thinking about what the day is going to bring, that all you're going to have a decision on is probably where you go to lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Not very exciting thinking versus a management style that says, hey, we've got a challenge here this morning. We're developing a new product. I've got several ideas, and my boss told me yesterday afternoon when I get there in the morning, come on in. We're going to sit down with three or four other people and discuss your idea and figure out which one you want to pursue and how we can help you pursuing it, how to pursue it. Wow. And when I'm in the shower, I'm pretty fired up facing that day versus the other day I described. And when you get people who all think like that, you get some people who not only come up with really great ideas on new products and services for your company, but how to execute them and get them into practice, you know, and you just unleash all these people doing that. It's just tremendously motivating. And why people don't embrace the other half of the great person, unleashing that person, I have no idea. I've thought about it for 35 years. It seems so simple, and an easy way to set yourself apart from your competitors by unleashing those great people. But people just don't do it. I don't know if it's ego or inferiority, like you talked about. I'm sure it's all those things. But the fact is, they don't do it.
Wow, I think I could just sit here and listen to you for days. I imagine that's why you're still teaching, because you have so much to share, and I'm sure your students love it. So, that was really...
Well, I was immersed in it for many, many years and been able to immerse other people in it. So, when you read it out of a book or hear somebody talk about it, it's one thing. When you're immersed in it and you see literally hundreds or, as I did, almost thousands of people on a daily basis in an organization. I don't want it to sound like utopia everybody's happy. Yeah, you have your challenges with all organizations because we're all humans. But by and large, when you see that on a daily basis, people coming around who are positive and motivated and almost happy to be at work. I don't know if any of us really like to work, but happy to be there because they know they're valued and they contribute. It leaves a real incredible impression on your life.
It really does. If you're going to spend half your life or more working, it should be meaningful for you. And I've had the privilege of working with some companies who have some pretty amazing cultures. And the people just have a different attitude about it. They like going to work. I remember facilitating a meeting one morning, and this new person, she had only been with the company for a month, and she had a cold. And she said, I was at home, and I was, had a cup of tea, and all I kept thinking was, if I can just get to work, I'll feel so much better. And I just,
wow.
I gave her a big hug because I was like, where do you hear things like that?
That's a great story.
Oh yeah, it made me feel proud to be there. And so that's the point. The point is that how can you find fulfillment through the work that you do instead of just clocking in and clocking out? So that you can have a purpose instead of just collecting a paycheck. And I think that's great. So
no question.
So is there a piece of advice that you have been given from all the amazing people that you have known and met through your life? Is there one particular bit of advice that you think is just maybe better than the rest?
Oh, goodness. I was trying to think.
I'll go first. So, one of my trainers told me one time, he says, if you want to really be successful in business, don't make it about yourself. Be others focused. Win through helping other people win, and don't make it about you, and don't try to be special. Just help other people feel like they're the ones who are special. And every time they win, they're going to want to help you win. So don't make it about yourself. Be others focused. And that really was something that I struggled with, because most of us are focused on self-preservation. That lizard brain in the back of our head, it has very strong survival instincts, and it wants us to protect our own, which you have to grow out of if you're going to be a servant leader. And so that is something that has always stayed with me.
Yeah, most of our cultures don't reward that, though. The 95% reward what the manager can bring to the table. What you have to do is flip the culture and say, your reward, Mr. Manager, comes from how successful your people are. Because then you called what Mr. McPherson, my old mentor, referred to as a barrier smasher. You have to, I'll give you a couple nuggets here that we use in training. And this company I worked for, I had 60,000 employees. All managers had to go through their management training school, their own management training school, before you could be a manager. Even a foreman on the shop floor in a UAW, and most of these were UAW plants, had to be in America when I worked in America, had to be trained. And one of the things we instilled in them is, you're not the be-all, end-all pot of knowledge. You are, as a manager, you are one, the keeper of the goals, and two, the main barrier smasher. In other words, when you run into adversity or any type of challenge and your employees come to you, you right away do not give them an answer. You do not answer their question for them. If they come and say, gosh, boss, I'm having trouble with this, your immediate response is, okay, what's the problem? How would you fix it? How would you take care of that? What would your improvement be? You show them that you're willing to give them responsibilities to take care of that as long as it meets the end goal. And me as a manager, I'm just the keeper of the goals. I hired you as a, I think you're a brilliant whatever in your whatever position you're in, and I trust you that you will come up with the greatest solution to fix that. The only thing I'm going to say is, Does it meet the goal? And the other thing as a manager I'm responsible for is when you do come up with an idea to solve that problem or have the next great invention, the thing that I'm, my primary responsibility is not to tell you how to do it, when to do it, and all that, but to say, all right, employee or group of employees, how can I, in my managerial position, help break down barriers so you can get there with better efficiency, with better cost, with a better outcome? Not to tell you how to do it, but to, you know, be your barrier smasher to go out there and run over barriers so you can succeed. You know, that's really kind of 180 degrees from what we're used to. You know, boss, I've got this problem. What does boss say? Oh, here's how to fix it. Boss, I'm going to develop this. I've got this new idea. Bring it into me, and we'll decide what to do. And you go ahead and meet with all these people to try to figure out how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it. No. As a boss, I'll take care of that. As a manager, I'll take care of that. I'll set up the contacts, all that. I'll knock down the barriers so you can be more efficient. It's so contrary to what we do, but it makes so much sense because it makes our people so much more motivated, so much more efficient. It uses their talents to the ultimate. And that's what we're going to do. But the way we're conditioned in management is, wow, if it looks like the manager is doing nothing, wow, why do we need that manager? But shouldn't a manager be judged on the ultimate performance of his employees? Let's look at it that way. So we kind of condition our managers to, come in and take all the credit and all that because that makes them look good because we reward that kind of behavior. And we don't want to reward that kind of behavior. We want to, the manager should almost be, in a sense, transparent, working behind the scenes to keep his folks focused on the goals and knocking down barriers and making them look good in the sense of successful, being successful.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, common sense is not so common anymore. And I love how you have flipped that around. I have had that particular conversation with hundreds of managers over the last few years. That very thing, because on the one hand, managers will complain because everybody constantly comes to them with their problems to fix things, so they can't get their own work done. But then on the other hand, they're not teaching people how to do exactly what you said, how to become self-reliant, how to encourage them to solve their own problems, how to grow through their own pains, how to make mistakes and learn from it and fail forward, and all the things that you said. And once they do that, then everybody becomes more successful. So I love the whole new reward system where you are rewarding managers specifically for how their team is performing and not what the manager is accomplishing him or herself. I think that's fabulous. And I love the idea of managers are keepers of the goal and barrier smashers. I've not heard that before. I think that's fantastic. So, all right, one final question because I'm so curious. Is there something that you learned from being in Germany where maybe the Germans do something better than the Americans when it comes to business and then vice versa where Americans maybe have an edge over the Germans in business since you've had the experience of being in both worlds?
Yeah. Definitely one thing that I've learned is, and this is, again, kind of learning from the failure or the negative. I don't know you or how many people out there on the podcast will recognize it, but I'm still kind of a car geek in a sense, although I ran a large medical products company, but still kind of a car geek. But if you notice in relative terms, the quality of German automobiles is not what it used to be. And that's not because the quality is less now than it was 20 years ago with German automobiles. It's because everybody else's quality, the South Koreans, the Japanese, and even us in America to a certain extent, our quality has gotten better and better and better and kind of surpassed them. And this leads me to my point that the one real cultural problem in German business is that they have some very talented technical people, and they create some great products. But once they think they have a great product, they lock down that product like the Big Mac sauce and say, we're never going to change it. Maybe the Big Mac sauce is a bad example because it still is pretty good.
Or like Coca-Cola. You can't. But, some things you don't want to change.
Exactly. Yeah, some things you don't want to change quite that rapidly or at all. But they have this mentality that once we find this great idea, never change it. And I think that's what, well, it's not I think, the evidence shows that that's what's happened in most of their products is they lock onto those and they don't constantly search for new innovations, unlike the Japanese. Now, when I was in Germany, this was kind of, I know it's going to sound kind of crazy, but I worked on a joint venture as an American who speaks German with Japanese because Bosch is considered the holy grail of OEM auto parts supplier who invented anti-lock brakes and fuel injection systems and all that type of thing. Well, the German counterpart is Nippon Denso, who is kind of that to the Japanese and South Korean automakers. So I worked on a joint venture, and it was so interesting to see the cultural dynamics between those two. The Germans would get an idea and hang on to it. The Japanese would get an idea, and their philosophy is, yes, that's the standard until we find a better way to do it. And from the first day we develop this technology, we're going to start searching for a better way. Instantly, they automatically start searching for the next better way. Now, until they find that better way, they're going to keep doing it with high quality the way they do it now. Where the German culture is, we found a great way to make anti-lock brakes. Let's not search necessarily for a better way. There probably isn't a better way in their minds because they think they're really high-tech society, and they are. They have some very, very bright people technically. But to me, I think that's proven to be pretty foolish. You know, the minute you develop something and you put it into practice, and it's world leading in its field, you shouldn't rest on your laurels. You should almost immediately start looking at a way to improve it. The Japanese do that with a tremendous amount of success, and we do in this country with a large amount of success. The Germans don't seem to do that. They think they have the holy grail of whatever they have, and they kind of hang on. And I think it's been to their detriment. So that's cultural. But again, we're especially from a business standpoint, we're very, very integrated across the world. Mm-hmm. And I think they're starting to see that the evidence is pretty overwhelming that you aren't going to be as successful as you could possibly be if you hang on to that. And, you know, that's kind of the facts of the matter are Toyota is the largest automobile company in the world, not Daimler-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And the quality of Japanese products and South Korean products are much higher than German products by and large. So I think they're starting to get that message. But culturally, that was a kind of a big thing I had to take away from that in Germany.
Do you think the Japanese in part have that attitude of constant and never-ending improvement in part because of John Dewey going over there around World War II and embedding that philosophy of always looking for ways, you know, quality control, always looking for ways to improve?
Oh, absolutely. I've done a lot of studying on, in that area because we used, different methods that were like the famous Japanese scientist Taguchi, who invented the design of experiments, Taguchi method and all that, which the Japanese use today to understand the way different I don't want to get too technical, but the way different like automobile components interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole Taguchi method was developed from American scientists and engineers going over after World War II and kind of teaching them the methods and them embracing it. And the methods were here in the United States, but our company's not embracing those methods of continuous improvement.
Mm-hmm.
We really did invent the methods. They just embraced it. Again, took the leap of faith that we're going to embrace it. And then once they start seeing the success, saying, you know, there again, it's do you fear innovation? Do you fear trying something? Well, once you try it and it succeeds, you become a lot less fearful. You become a lot more encouraged that this is the right path to follow. And they embraced it and have made it one of the cornerstones. At least Toyota, who I worked with a lot, has embraced it as one of the cornerstones of how they've become successful.
Mm-hmm.
Continuous improvement. And there's no doubt that they believe in it 1,000%.
Wow. Well, this has been fantastic. I want to be mindful of your time because I think I could just keep coming up with questions. But, Mick, I want to thank you for the time and for your wisdom and for all the great answers and advice that you've shared. There's a lot to think about here, and I'm going to go through and listen to this again myself because I have lots of notes that I want to take and share with so many people out there. So thank you very much for your time today and for all the great advice that you've shared.
Oh, you're welcome, Tim. Anytime.
Yes. Is there anything in particular that that you're working on that you want to share or promote, or you're just happy to be here?
No, not really. Just kind of my single focus, solitary mission. Just try to get. I'm working with some companies, just trying to get companies to, you know, really embrace and understand the value of their people. I think most of them don't understand they're sitting on a gold mine, and that gold mine is the talent of their people. And if they would just learn how to, harness that unleash that, their company would do incredible things. They would be the most dominant in their industries, and maybe equally to me, as they would, you would walk around their facility and you would see, you know, fired up people, happy to, mm-hmm. like you said before, happy to come to work, happy to be at work. If we're going to be someplace 8 hours a day, we might as well be doing something valuable and have fun doing it. And you'd see people like that. And I just see that 5% is about all I see really doing that. A lot of folks talk about it,
mm-hmm.
but not too many have the courage and the stick-to-itiveness to really follow it through and see, you know, and see the value in it over a long period of time. And, you know, that gives me another 95% to help work on it. So that's pretty much you know, all I'm doing is trying to, you know, get them to unleash their folks and have a great work environment. So
yes, I talk to people all the time and I say a great culture is not a poster on the wall and you can wear jeans on Friday and have a pizza party once in a while and sometimes you gotta check to charity. That is not what a great culture is about.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
I see some great mission statements.
Yeah.
some really creative, really, really, you're reading the mission statement, I'm really getting motivated. But then, you know, I spend a little time with them and I find out they really don't do anything that the mission statement says. It all sounds flowery and great and motivating, but they, again, it's the old cliche, they don't walk the walk. So that's unfortunate. You know, Mr. McPherson used to talk about that too. He's like, you know, you can have an authoritarian management style, or you can have, there's three types of management style. You can talk people empowering, and you can be people empowering. You can talk people empowering and be authoritarian in your style, or you can say you're going to be authoritarian and you can be authoritarian. And as he said, if I had my choice, obviously the talk and preach the empowerment style and then actually employ the empowerment style. But he said the worst is when you tell people you're going to be people empowering, you're going to be open door, you're going to be open-minded, you're going to, you know, let them exploit their talents, and then you don't. That's worse than just being up front and saying, hey, if you come to work here, our culture is kind of very authoritarian. We're going to tell you what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. At least their expectations aren't shattered.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so right, because I've been into so many companies where, well, they tell us they have an open door policy, and they tell us they want to know what we have to say. But then we get the door slammed in our face, and we get told to, you know, keep your comments to yourself and all that, you know, because they've set the expectation, and you think, wow, this is going to be a really cool place to work. And then when you get there, they've not really told you the truth. And that ends up being worse than if you're just told up front, hey, don't expect to, you know, for us to take your ideas and all that. At least the expectations are there that you're not going to be able to share your talents and ideas. So,
yeah,
I think it's wise to kind of heed that.
It absolutely is. It's a very different feeling. You know, as I listen to you, I'm thinking about the experiences I've had. Most of the time, you know, being a therapist and a coach, well, I start my conversations with people, whether it's on the phone or it's at a company or it was at their office. It always starts with, "Hang on, let me close the door." You know,
yeah.
Because they were gonna talk about things, and you know, one of the companies that I've been with for a number of years, the president of the company, his door is always open. And I remember, you know, a couple of months ago, I came in there, and just out of habit, I went to close the door, and he said, "What are you doing?" He says, "That door stays open. You know, there's nothing that we're going to talk about that, you know, I wouldn't want anybody else to hear." He was just really was pushing transparency, and I was so impressed by that. I was like, wow. So out of all the years, I've only closed the door once because I said we need to close the door for this one.
But, I want to give that gentleman an A+.
Yeah, he deserves
it. He gets an A+ grade, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, outstanding. Well, thank you, Mick. I really appreciate this.
Okay.
You've been so generous with your time, and I look forward to spending more time with you in the future. And thanks so much for being with
us.
And everybody else that's listening, thank you for being here. And I hope that you take all the wisdom that Mick has shared with you, and you use it, you apply it, and you empower yourself, and you empower those you serve, and make today and every day a sure success. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you really enjoyed it, please subscribe and share it with your friends. And if you want more psychological secrets for making your business and your life a sure success, go to timshure.com/newsletter and join our family of achievers who are living their dreams and making the world a better place. Check it out now and make your life a sure success.